Well, it's one thing to be besotted by the stars, but it's quite another to be starry-eyed. When Cupid fires his arrow, everything changes. Everything is well with the world. We are optimistic. We are often blind to the realities around us. And as we continue our series this morning on the greatest story ever told, we're going to see three things. Firstly, the promise from a starry-eyed God. Secondly, the problem from the perspective of a down-to-earth realist. And thirdly, the resolution from a God who made the stars. So firstly, the promise from a starry-eyed God. In Genesis 12, as you will recall from last week, God made some pretty big promises. He promised to bless, and he did that by saying that he would make Abram into a great nation, that he would make his name great, that he would bless him, and that all peoples on earth would be blessed through him. Now, these appear to be some starry-eyed promises, not at all grounded in reality. And as we come to chapter 15, the word of this starry-eyed God comes to Abram in a vision, and he says, verse 1, "Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield, your very great reward." But Abram is thinking, "I don't know where this reward is coming from." For Abram outlines the problem from an earthly perspective. And so in verses 2 to 3, we see the problem from a down-to-earth realist. And we read, "But Abram said, 'O sovereign Lord, what can you give me since I remain childless, and the one who will inherit my estate is Eliezer of Damascus?' And Abram said, 'You have given me no children, so a servant in my household will be my heir.'" He had been promised that he would be made into a great nation. At this rate, he won't even be made into a great family. He had been promised that his name would be great. At this point, he will only be remembered as a loser. He had been promised that God would bless him. Well, this was a funny way of going about it. He had been promised that all peoples on earth would be blessed through him. At this point, not even he appears to be blessed. And then the starry-eyed God speaks to him in verse 4. And so we read, "Then the word of the Lord came to him, 'This man will not be your heir, but a son coming from your own body will be your heir.' He took him outside and said, 'Look up at the heavens and count the stars, if indeed you can count them.' Then he said to him, 'So shall your offspring be.'" It sure sounds like someone who is starry-eyed, not at all grounded in reality. From a human perspective, this is impossible. But not so with God. This is the God who flung the stars into space, the God who owns the depths of the sea, the expanse of the desert, and the outer galaxies of our universe. Abraham responded in the way that only a child of God could. We read in verse 6, "Abram believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness." As the book of Hebrews tells us, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. Faith, friends, is trusting God even when the circumstances look totally different. Faith is obeying even when we don't know where it will lead. As Hebrews again said about Abraham, "By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going." And then in Genesis 15, verses 7 and 8, we read, "He also said to him, 'I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to take possession of it.' But Abram said, 'O sovereign Lord, how can I know that I will gain possession of it?' And then from verse 9, we have the enactment of the covenant with Abram. The word covenant occurs 285 times in the Old Testament, telling us how important it is as a theme. And this covenant, the idea of covenant, conveys the idea of a solemn commitment, guaranteeing promises or obligations made by one or both of the covenanting parties. And so reading from verse 9. So the Lord said to him, "Bring me a heifer, a goat and a ram, each 3 years old, along with a dove and a young pigeon." Abram brought all these to him, cut them in two, and arranged the halves opposite each other. The birds, however, he did not cut in half. Then birds of prey came down on the carcasses, but Abram drove them away. As the sun was setting, Abram fell into a deep sleep, and a thick and dreadful darkness came over him. Then the Lord said to him, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated 400 years. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterwards they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your fathers in peace and be buried at a good old age." In verse 13, did you notice that another problem raises its head? We read, "Then the Lord said to him, 'Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated 400 years.'" The resolution of the problem of descendants is assumed, but if he was to be made into a great nation, then descendants is not enough. What else do you need? Land, that's right, let's all say it. Land. If you're going to be a nation, you need the land, not just the people. But the problem is, they are going to be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated there. But this starry-eyed God promises in verses 14 to 15, "But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your ancestors in peace and be buried at a good old age." For the second part, at least, we can go to Genesis 25 for its fulfillment, where we read in verses 7 and 8, "Abraham lived 175 years. Then Abraham breathed his last and died at a good old age, an old man full of years, and he was gathered to his people." For the first part, we need to turn to Exodus, where we will go shortly. But firstly, let us look at the enactment of the covenant from verse 17. "When the sun had set and darkness had fallen, a smoking fire pot with a blazing torch appeared and passed between the pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram and said, 'To your descendants I give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the Euphrates, and to all those ites' lands.'" Saves me reading them all. Unlike the covenant of circumcision in chapter 17 that you looked at last week, the commitment here is one-sided. There is no demand of Abram. It is only the Lord God who passes through the dissected animals. And this is seen in the imagery of fire and smoke that represents the presence of God. And this tells us that God alone took on obligations. Abram remained a passive spectator of the ritual. And the obligation that God took on was to give them land so as to fulfill the commitment in Genesis 12 of nationhood. We read in verse 18, "On that day the Lord made a covenant with Abram and said, 'To your descendants I give this land.'" And he gives the land of all those exotic sounding places. Well, let us now turn to Exodus for the unfolding of the promise. For there we see the resolution from the God who made the stars. In chapter 1, the problem is still before us. And true to God's word, the Israelites are strangers in a country not their own, the land of Egypt. The people were numerous. The promise of descendants had been fulfilled, but the problem of land still lay before them. The new Egyptian ruler, scared of the sheer number of the Israelites, verse 11, put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labour. In verse 14 we read, they made their lives bitter with harsh labour in brick and mortar, with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their harsh labour, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. But in chapter 2, 23 and 24 we read, during that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. God remembered his covenant and heard their groaning. We are aware that for 400 years they were oppressed, and through a series of plagues, the God of Israel showed who truly was in charge. And yet the Pharaoh still would not let the people go. And when we come to Exodus 12, we come to the resolution, or the beginning of the resolution, of the problem of no land. And we read here of the institution of the Passover. So follow with me. Chapter 12, verses 1 to 8. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in Egypt, this month is to be for you the first month of your year. Tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household. If any household is too small for a whole lamb, they must share one with their nearest neighbour, having taken into account the number of people there are. You are to determine the amount of lamb needed in accordance with what each person will eat. The animals you choose must be year-old males without defect, and you may take them from the sheep or the goats. Take care of them until the 14th day of the month, when all the people of the community of Israel must slaughter them at twilight. Then they are to take some of the blood and put it on the sides and tops of the door frames of the houses where they eat the lambs. That same night, they are to eat the meat roasted over the fire, along with bitter herbs and bread made without yeast. And then from verse 12, on that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn, both men and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. This is a day you are to commemorate. For the generations to come, you shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord, a lasting ordinance. And then from verse 21, then Moses summoned all the elders of Israel and said to them, go at once and select the animals for your families and slaughter the Passover lamb. Take a bunch of hyssop, dip it into the blood in the basin and put some of the blood on the top and on both sides of the door frame. Not one of you shall go out the door of his house until morning. When the Lord goes through the land to strike down the Egyptians, he will see the blood on the top and sides of the door frame and will pass over that doorway. And he will not permit the destroyer to enter your houses and strike you down. The Lord was true to his word, for we read from verse 29. At midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on the throne to the firstborn of the prisoner who was in the dungeon, and the firstborn of all the livestock as well. Pharaoh and all his officials and all the Egyptians got up during the night, and there was loud wailing in Egypt, for there was not a house without someone dead. During the night, Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron and said, up, leave my people, you and the Israelites. Go worship the Lord as you have requested. Take your flocks and herds as you have said, and go and also bless me. The Egyptians urged the people to hurry and leave the country, for otherwise, they said, we will all die. So the people took their dough before the yeast was added and carried it on their shoulders in kneading troughs wrapped in clothing. The Israelites did as Moses instructed and asked the Egyptians for articles of silver and gold and for clothing. The Lord had made the Egyptians favorably disposed toward the people, and they gave them what they asked for. So they plundered the Egyptians. God had a double purpose in this deliverance. Firstly, he determines to deliver them from Egypt. But secondly, he wills to bring his people to himself by redemption. And he does this through the blood of the Passover lamb. So turn back to chapter 6, verses 6 and 7. Therefore say to the Israelites, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment. I will take you as my own people, and I will be your God. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God, who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. This blood satisfies the justice of God in relation to those who claim its protection. It satisfies God's justice, for it substitutes for the blood of the one who paints it on the doorpost. In every Egyptian house, one lies dead. In every Israelite house, one lies dead. The slaughtered lamb. For the Israelites, the judgment of God has fallen on a substitute. The message to them, as to us, is to trust in God's sacrifice. It will keep you safe from God's judgment. And of course, the sacrifice that we look to is not to that of an unblemished animal, but to an unblemished human. For at another time, in another place, there would be the one true sufficient sacrifice for the sins of the whole world. It is no mistake that Jesus died at Passover time. For the Israelites, the blood of the Lamb protected them because they trusted and obeyed God. They, from now on, are to remember this night and impress it on their collective consciousness and pass it on to their children. The meaning of the Passover lamb is to be impressed on children from generation to generation. They are always to remember who they are, or better, whose they are. Israel's identity is a function of what God has done for them. Israel, as God's son, was redeemed, that is, delivered from Egyptian bondage by the death of Egypt's firstborn sons. And this is a graphic reminder of the lengths that God will go to save his children, his firstborn son, Israel. Life comes from death. And it takes our thoughts forward, yes, to another time and another place. But we haven't arrived there yet as we continue our journey through the Bible. Keep coming back, friends, week by week. The passing over was on the basis of the blood, and only on that basis, that the destroyer made the distinction between Israel and Egypt. There is no preferential treatment here on the basis of colour or race. It is faith in the shed blood that must be exercised. Friends, this optimistic God who made those promises to Abraham is not starry-eyed without cause. He makes outlandish promises that he can keep. He makes outlandish promises that he can and did fulfill. And so the question for us today is, will we trust him? When life is tough, when the circumstances are bleak, when it appears foolish to trust, remember the faithfulness of God to his word of promise. He will do what he said he will do. He promised Abraham an heir, and against all the odds, it happened. He promised that Israel would be a great nation, and despite the 400 years of bondage in Egypt, he delivered, where they escaped not through the back door, but the front door with dignity, and having plundered the Egyptians' goods. Friends, the divine word, regardless of how things appear, humanly speaking, will come to pass, and so is deserving of confidence. Will you trust this God? In good times, when you're tempted to think you don't need him, and in the bleak times, when you are in your darkest hours, will you believe the God who has promised to deliver us to a heavenly land? Will you trust him and have it reckoned to you as righteousness? Will you, friend, be a man or woman of faith? For what we have seen is that we can count on God's promises staying true. In Hebrews 11, we read of Abraham. By faith, he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. And the writer to the Hebrews goes on. By faith, Abraham, even though he was past age, and Sarah herself was barren, was enabled to become a father because he considered him faithful who had made the promise. And so from this one man, and he as good as dead, came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sand on the seashore. Friends, we don't have to be starry-eyed to trust this God. For we have every reason to believe that God will deliver, that he continues to bring his plans to fruition. And so, like Abraham, despite the changes and chances of this fleeting world, we can look forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. We sang at 8 o'clock the hymn by Martin Luther, and although they take our wife, our goods, our children, our life, the city of God remaineth. Despite appearances, we too should consider him faithful who has made promises, for faithful and true is he. May that encourage us. May that comfort us. And may that motivate us to live for the one who made outlandish promises long ago and delivered and continues to do so. Go forth strengthened, O men and women of faith. Amen.